natural ability that's you can't coach. It's hard to coach.
For me, he's one of the most talented players in the country.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Get into your flow with the new Gillette Labs Razor with exfoliating bar.
All right, bang on 7:30 this morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. It's Jarn Owen with you in studio all the way through until 10. Also with us this morning is Nathan Murphy. Nathan, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, everybody.
So I want to start a little bit with where we were yesterday on the show. We had Vinnie Perth in studio talking about the League of Ireland game, and he was kind of surprised at the reaction that there had been to the Rovers game because of the goal in the pass from Jack Byrne. He was kind of making the point that the rest of the game was grand, and you know, off air afterwards we were kind of having the conversation that actually that's fine in the era of social media. Two or three highlights in a game is kind of all you need for everybody to go, oh, I want to go to this thing.
Yeah, I think for the league and getting people interested and involved and excited about it, a Jack Byrne pulling off a goal like that in the past like that does get people thinking, should I go to Tala on a Friday night? It doesn't maybe reflect the quality of the game, but actually I thought the game was a pretty entertaining game. Drogheda are a good side. They get the ball down, they pass it around, and Rovers sort of did what Rovers do, which is they ground it out, they had a lot of possession, and Jack Byrne was good, but I think Jack, as he admitted himself in the interview, has a long way to go. He gave the ball away quite a bit, but he's always trying to do something. He's almost trying to do too much. He's trying to force the issue constantly. He's always looking for that killer pass, perhaps at times when it's not really on. But it does feel as though you can get very quickly now all the exciting things that happen, whether it is a sprinkler going off. It's a talking point. It's something that happened. I don't see it as this massive embarrassment to the league.
I don't either.
Crazy things happen everywhere.
Yeah. But I think if you're involved in the league, you're pretty sensitive about that kind of stuff, because it is, like, obviously not great, but like it happens in like all over the world.
When they were parading the Club World Cup at Chelsea last week, I mean, the lads got sprinkled. Chilwell and was it Reece James who brought the Club World Cup onto the pitch? That is one thing that happens everywhere. The wheelbarrow just made it funnier.
Like, that was it, yeah.
Like, I don't think people were laughing at the league.
It turned it into high art.
Yeah.
Well, there was that hashtag greatest league in the world, which every time something would go wrong was thrown up, and it would be thrown up a lot over the course of the season.
But is that not actually endearing? It's like we're a self-reflexive bunch of fans who really like this thing that everybody shits on, but shouldn't, because actually it's kind of enjoyable and grassrootsy.
I think it's a frustration that a lot of people don't take the league seriously because of incidents like that. Rightly or wrongly. So I think that's where the frustration and the protectionism is around clips like that going up and going viral. Because, yeah, well, League of Ireland fans and people who watch a lot of football would go, ah, fine. Those who aren't that interested, who might, you know, the sort of floating voter are looking going, geez, this is amateur hour. Whereas a lot of people have their minds made up about the League of Ireland.
I think a lot of people had their minds made up about the League of Ireland. I think things have changed over the last number of years. I think that you trace it back to Michael O'Neill and that Rovers run, and from then to here, there's been a journey that a lot of Irish football fans have gone on and gone, well, actually, you know what? I mean, look at this. Okay, all right. Now I'm watching. Like, that's how it happens, and it's going to be a drip, 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 and then overnight success.
Hopefully. What does an overnight success look like, though? Because a lot of the teams, unfortunately, and clubs aren't in a position to take advantage of overnight success. So,
well, obviously, there's no such thing as an overnight success. Like, that's the point. Luton Town were out of the league, and now they're on the verge of going back to the Premier League. It took 14 years for them. That's an overnight success. But everybody is saying, because they're in the cup tonight, it's like, oh, that came out of nowhere. But it didn't. It came out of hard decisions made 14, 15 years ago by ownership and community planning and reaching out and having a vision and sticking with the vision through thick and thin. That's like overnight success is obviously what the general perception would be, is like that came out of nowhere, but actually the building blocks are here now. Sorry, just to cut across you there.
That's fine. I think there's good things been done. I'd say everybody's wary of false dawns that, you know, when Dundalk and Cork had a proper rivalry going, it felt like the league was on the cusp of something, and then Cork just disappeared and find themselves down in the first division. Obviously, Dundalk has been a complete shit show for the last couple of years as well. Maybe they can get things back together, but both of those juggernauts have fallen away. And it did feel if you think the last game out in Tala was the Jordan Flores goal, Jack Byrne winner game, packed house. It felt at that stage, just pre-COVID, that it was on the verge of something. And maybe now it can get back there quickly. When you look at the season ticket sales for all of the Dublin clubs are pretty much at record levels. And I think there is a real connection between what happens with the Irish senior team now and an understanding that while you may not see football quite of the quality that you will see in the Premier League, you don't need to. That actually you can go to any of these matches and you'll see an entertaining game. By and large, the football is decent. You know, you'll see a bad game, but you'll see, you know, you'll see a crap game in the Premier League. I watched Liverpool and Manchester United over the years. It's never usually the most exciting game of the season. So at times, people's expectations can be too high. They're looking for faults constantly. I thought Shamrock Rovers draw at a game on Monday night was one of the more entertaining games I've been at recently. Plenty of chances, good football, good pace to it, bit of quality in Jack Byrne and Graham Burke. And you know, people are getting a ticket there, I'd say, for, what, 15, 17 quid? I don't think you can complain too much about that.
I'd agree with you, and I think that if you want to compare it to, say, what you're getting in the Premier League, for example, I know that there is a title race on it, maybe Liverpool will be Premier League champions, but if we kind of cling to this notion that existed a month ago of Manchester City being the standard bearers right now in the Premier League, I mean, there is definitely a theme out there that they aren't overly exciting to watch because they are so good that it's all, we've almost got to this point where it's like this perfectionism actually isn't as entertaining as it once was. Whereas if you put them up against teams of a similar standard, which invariably tends to be Liverpool, and you've got opportunities and you've got chances and you're not quite sure which way the game is going to go, and that is the key point of it, a football game that has chances and that you don't know which way it's going to go, that draws people in, right? It doesn't necessarily need to be a 30 million euro winger who is creating the opportunities, as long as there are opportunities.
Jeopardy. Uncertainty of outcome.
Exactly, that's it. That's what you want. And every league in the world can produce that. And it's just about, I guess, access and the experience that you have when you're a match scorer or as a match viewer at home that kind of takes that to the next level.
And a title race. Like, that's what it needs this season. And that's why that goal for Derry feels important for the league on Friday night, because if Rovers had won that, they would have been 5 points clear of Derry. Derry dropped points again on Monday. And that's sort of what Shamrock Rovers did last season, particularly in around April. They scored an insane amount of late goals, ground out results, and next thing you find yourself 10 points clear. And you have 2/3 of the season left to go.
Yeah.
And everybody knows the title race is done. So why are you dragging yourself out on a Friday night or a Monday night to go to a match? Whereas I think now, if that the other teams can stay in touch, and obviously, you know, Derry do drop points, Pats haven't beaten Shelburne on the opening night, suddenly you fall back again, that there is an opportunity for Rovers to just keep winning their games and everyone else beats everybody else. But,
and look, that probably will happen. Rovers are further down the line than most other teams, and you would, maybe the injection of money into Derry is going to allow them to catch up sooner rather than later. And that's why the other narratives in the league are very important. That's why Duffer and his little sprinkling of stardust is hugely important, and hit their battle against relegation. Hopefully they don't just become a mid-table team 6 weeks in and that's it. There's no jeopardy as well. But him fighting against relegation is going to be one of the great Irish sports stories of 2022. I do want to just broaden this out a little bit, because obviously if you just woke up and you don't know what happened last night, Antonio Conte pulled his trick 10 days ago after they got beaten by Burnley, who are also beaten last night in the league by Leicester. What the hell? But anyway, and then last night they went out to Middlesbrough in the cup. It's like, what? This isn't supposed to happen. They turned a corner.
Yeah, I saw a quote tweet online this morning.
Tweet. Hey, you might have invented that.
Yeah, good man.
And it was in reaction to Tottenham last night, and it was, I'm done with this team. And I was like, oh my God, it's Conte. And it was actually just a phoner into TalkSport. But I could fully have believed that. If Conte was like, I'm done with this team, I would have fully believed it. But actually, I think it's Football.London have done a full transcript of his quotes, and I went through them with a tooth comb, and there was no sense of Antonio Conte being like, I'm done with this team, or maybe I'm not a good manager this week. So maybe he just welcomes the idea of fighting on one front at this point. Although he played a pretty strong team.
I played pretty much a full strength team,
yeah,
out there last night. Harry Kane is playing, Heung-Min Son is playing. They had chances. Matt Doherty missed a really good opportunity, went around the keeper at one stage and should have just pulled it across to Heung-Min Son and said, smashes it over the bar. Doherty played all right, actually. But like, this level of inconsistency, some of it has to land at the manager's door. it's too easy, and all the analysis is it's Spursy. Like, this is what Spurs
it is. Spursy
are.
Though it's mad.
Maurizio Pochettino turned them into something else. Antonio Conte, we all felt when he went in there, they were getting somehow one of that real top tier of managers in world football. And instead of fixing this, he's just looking around constantly going, Spursy lads, this is very Spursy.
Well,
Your job is to change that.
It is. But he's only had 8 weeks. Like, it's hard in a very short period of time to come in and fix things. Like, most of the long-term great successes have been built on a couple of seasons of ridding the club of whatever cancers were in it. If you think back to Ferguson, like, no manager's ever going to get the same amount of time that Ferguson had, right? And I'm not suggesting that Antonio Conte should, because his Spurs team are actually better than the Man United team that that Ferguson inherited. But it took him absolutely ages. Like, ages and ages and ages and ages. And it's going to take Conte quite a long time if Spurs believe that they're capable of being a tier one footballing entity, right? Like, so, I don't know. The constant referendum that he has introduced after that early period on his future, that's weird. Because he knew what the situation was. He knew what the playing stock was like. He'd already spoken to the club 6 months ago. It doesn't make any sense that, like, managers now seem to exist in an accelerated culture where they want to make decisions quickly, then see, make the decision, move on, and try and emerge unscathed.
Well, the best case scenario was he would come in, they would sign 4 or 5 players. But again, if they were going to sign Dusan Vlahovic, a deal like that surely is already underway. Before or the day he arrives, if that's a key signing for him, that's got to start happening quickly. It can't have been a shock to him that at the end of the transfer window, the only 2 players they ended up signing were the 2 guys coming in from Juventus, and that they had let 4 players go who he never really seemed bothered about any of them. Like, that cannot have come as this massive shock and a betrayal by Daniel Levy. That is how Daniel Levy has always worked. So for him to go in and somehow think that Tottenham is going to magically change is a bit of a lack of due diligence, which...
Or else we're misreading all the stuff that he's saying, and he actually... It's just his mode of speaking, and that he will be there for the long haul, and the notion that he's going to walk out for whatever reason is nonsense. That this is all just... that's part of the carnival. I don't know if I paid enough attention at Chelsea, but maybe because things went well, this didn't happen. Maybe this...
It was a very bad start, and then it got good very quickly because he changed formation. But that happened within, like, 6-7
weeks.
Games,
yeah,
of the season. So, like...
But it brings a level of uncertainty. So I think he's misplaying his hand there because, as you were saying, after every single match, the first thing you're waiting for last night is, what's Antonio Conte going to do? Like, is he actually going to resign? Is he going to resign because he was humiliated last night by Middlesbrough?
Yeah, he's got nowhere left to go.
That drags on, like that line of, you know, there's one club in crisis all the time, you just don't want to be that club. Like, he is ensuring that Tottenham are that club week on week.
Well, luckily Manchester United have the current franchise on that. Their obviously press conference, wasn't it? But it was a was it a fan forum? Was that where they were all talking?
Yeah.
Where the explanation of what Darren Fletcher's role was after Ralf Rangnick was like, I don't know what he does. He didn't quite say he doesn't know what he does, but he's like, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. And then Fletcher was like, oh, when the transition happened between the 2 coaching staffs, I kind of came in and started being on the training ground. It's like, when you listen and you just take everybody's comments in, it doesn't seem to make that much sense. So Fletcher said, my job is to get the pathway for young players to come through and make it to the first team. It's working very well at the moment. Look at Alanga. Right. Okay, fair enough. Now, Alanga's obviously been at Manchester United since he was 12, right?
Mm.
So how long is Fletcher in the role? 18 months? Because he was talking about doing talking about doing podcasts 2 years ago, right? So, like, at the start of COVID. So it's not that long. He can't really claim that much credit for Alanga, can he?
It's hard to know who's actually brought him through. And I think that there's also a sense that, like, somebody said stop on Alanga going out on loan, obviously.
Yeah,
and
Rangnick claimed credit for it.
Just about to say, then, that press conference last week after he spoke, after he scored last week, that it was him that spotted this guy who was about to be let go and told him to stop. So I think everybody, whenever anything goes right at Manchester United, likes to claim credit for it. And, like, Richard Arnold yesterday, I think if you're if you're coming to this thing new and you don't know Manchester United's form over the last couple of years, you'd be pretty excited about where Manchester United are going to go, because Richard Arnold's a bit like Ed Woodward, can talk a good game and can, I guess, beef up hopes quite nicely over the next little while. Like he's saying that he is implementing a strategy to win, and he says everyone associated with Manchester United should have belief in the opportunities that lie ahead for us, both on the pitch and in the way we engage and serve our fans. And he says we have a clear vision, and we are implementing a strategy to win with an empowered leadership team to drive that forward. So it'd be interesting to see if that clear vision manifests itself.
Did the debt figure get reported widely?
It did.
An extra 50 million up to 500 million. Doesn't seem to be an issue, although the stadium is crumbling. They've obviously had to cut ties with Aeroflot. The team is not performing. Things could get into a tailspin pretty quickly for Manchester United if things went bad, if there was, you know, say, a global shock coming. So I think it's not all certain. And their wage bill went up 19 million.
Yeah, like, so just from some of the writing done on it yesterday, their second quarter results for fiscal 2022 showed the club paid £10 million in exceptional items, which include a compensation to Solskjaer and also other members of the coaching staff. And then that figure also took into account a revaluation of the Football League pension scheme deficit. And then the results showed an operating profit of £5.4 million for the quarter, with revenue up to £185 million, up 7.3%. But then it gets to your figure there. The net debt has increased by 8.6%. Player wages were up 19.6%.
Oh, 19.6%, not 90 million. I was thinking
to 97.7 million pounds. So that's a constant ticking along.
Cristiano Ronaldo shaped increase there.
Yeah, I mean they did give that new contract to Henderson as well. It's like you get good value for spending 5 million on your sub goalkeeper per annum. Liverpool's is £300,000. You know, not that it's fair to compare and contrast.
Yeah, but I think if you are running your business properly, you can sell Dean Henderson, who is much sought after in the summer, for 25, 30 million.
Last summer.
Contract is worthwhile.
Last summer.
Well, last summer, or this summer coming.
Will he still get that amount? Because it's, you know, it's very much a what have you done for me lately league. Are you going to spend 20 million on this? Maybe you are, because it seems to have worked for Villa, and I'd like to have seen him play a year. You know, if he'd gone on loan this year and had a year similar to the year he had at Sheffield United. Anyway, sorry, all of this is kind of by. The other big story overnight, and I'll get to that in just a moment, but a reminder, OTBAM is brought to you live each morning by Gillette Labs for an effortless finish to your day. At 7:47, here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock. Special treat for us all this morning, Tommy Walsh at 10 past 8. Virtual Insanity with John Duggan at 8:45. It's a double weekend tournament. Sports pages at 9, Phil Egan football at 10 past 9, and Eric Donovan in very reflective mood after his defeat at the weekend, potentially his last fight. So we'll see. You can listen in on that from 9:30 this morning. Now, the other big story overnight is that the London Times are reporting that Abramovich might be ready to sell Chelsea, that he has in the past refused to sell, turned down offers around the 2 billion mark, and they're saying that now all bets are off. There's a Labour MP who was part of the select committee on Russia who says that Abramovich is selling off his property assets in London. He's got a load of property assets. There's the New York Post also did this thing yesterday where the Upper East Side, the Russian oligarchs own a large portion of the Upper East Side. You know, 3 or 4 buildings in a row. I think Abramovich had numbers 73, 74 and 75 on the same street. And, you know, it's not like... It's not like a two-story, two up, two down type thing. It's like a, you know, it's big. So there's a lot of money tied up in that, and probably pretty easy to sell if you need cash in a hurry. Thomas Tuchel obviously snapped yesterday in the press conference, and it felt like he'd been asked the same question repeatedly, but was it only twice?
I think so. I think it was early in the press conference. Anyway, it was maybe his second time being asked about it in the press conference.
Yeah, I understand Tuchel. The written quotes are actually they're more reflective than the video, and it's hard to shake the video where it's like, why are you doing asking me this question? I'm a football manager. Whereas the reflective quotes were like, everybody has this in the back of their head since the war started. Everybody is distracted by it. Of course we are. I'm going about my job. Like, I presume you are going about your job slightly distracted by this too. But he was asked about Abramovich, and Abramovich is the most important person at Chelsea. Like, he was on the pitch with the World Club Championship in Abu Dhabi just a couple of weeks ago with the trophy. He has put all the money in that has transformed Chelsea from Spurs to the one of the top four biggest clubs and most successful clubs in English football. And, you know, his rationale and his reason behind that is fairly evident. Like, it's fairly obvious why it's important, if you're an oligarch, to have some kind of financial instrument like Chelsea to, you know, be able to put money into, and then also to use it as something to kind of to exist in the world.
And he's got the biggest bolt in the world, so
yeah,
having the European champions, the World Club Cup winners, even among the oligarchs, it's a bit of a prize.
It seems to matter, but I think it also gave him a kind of power and kudos in polite English society for a while, up until they refused his visa, and then obviously he seems to have recalibrated his desires. And then there was the stuff last week, it's like, oh, he's not involved in politics. And then there was the other stuff, it's like, oh no, he's trying to broker peace. Like, and then it's, oh, I'm going to hand it over to my charity, and the charity are like, hang on a second, what? I'm not sure about this. So now the story comes out that he's interested in selling, and it makes perfect sense. But you do have to think that if English football, and if football generally, isn't looking at what's going on with Abramovich and thinking, this isn't good, does the contagion stop at Abramovich? Is he the only owner that anybody has a problem with? Because it's clearly not. Like, allowing football to become the playthings of billionaires was great for the fans in a fantasy football kind of way, in that it was like, oh, I get the best players in my team, and you know, the quality of the football that I see improves. But in the long run, it completely devalues the experience of being a fan of that club, because you're now a plaything for billionaires, and you're now really almost a victim of your supporterhood. Was it Johnny Liu pointing out that as soon as you start liking a team, the team looks at you and places a numerical money value on you to try and exploit? Is that the point of football? Maybe it is. Maybe the only reason we do anything is so that we can be exploited for our money. Maybe that's exactly why the world exists. I don't know. Maybe that was all of humanity was all coming to this point where you're worth X euros to whoever is watching you, and you're watching the TV, and you're like sitting there on your couch going, and there's like a little money figure over your head magically going up and down depending on which button you press.
Like, I mean, if the question is what should football stand for, it obviously shouldn't be that. But the reality is, this is where we are. And I mean, this has come up at various times over the last couple of years when we kind of wonder to ourselves, how far will football actually push the boat out? And I think all we've seen over the last week is that a line in the sand has been drawn, and we now know that your owner being associated with the invasion of a democratic country in Europe, which is an important point here, in Europe, is the line in the sand. Everything before that line in the sand, that includes bombing Yemen, is absolutely fine in the world of football, because that is exactly what's happened here. And that even goes among some of the good owners in the Premier League, who voted pretty closely unanimously to allow Saudi Arabia into the league, to allow that money to come into the league. And I think the answer to your question is football all about the value that you place on each consumer? I think the answer to that question is blatantly yes. It absolutely is. That is what football is all about. That is what Premier League football is all about. There is no argument that you can make to convince anybody otherwise.
Okay. And fair enough, then that's grand. But like, what an enjoyable thing it is to be a part of this. Manchester City obviously is effectively owned by the UAE, right? They own Mumbai City, Melbourne City, New York City, Manchester City. Effectively owned by the Abu Dhabi United Group for Development and Investment. So it's as clear that that's a state owning that club as it is that Saudi Arabia own Newcastle. Abu Dhabi abstained in the vote at the UN. Like, what's the difference between them and Abramovich, and what's the difference? What is the difference, really? Like, when it comes down to it, and you tease it all out, there's no real difference. These are all being bought for political reasons. And I don't think... you can kind of go as far as saying, well, what, like, ultimately, if it's just, if, I guess, I think there's an opportunity here, right? We keep getting told you can't print money, and then the pandemic comes along and money gets printed. Oh, you can't give people a universal wage. It would be wrong. It would be moral hazard. But then the pandemic comes along and everybody got a universal wage because nobody could go to work. And the world didn't fall apart. There's a bit of debt, but they're going to just write it off over a period of time because that's what happens. You can do whatever you want if you want to. And now they're talking about seizing the assets of the oligarchs. We're just going to take that stuff that you have because you're connected in some way to Putin. So if you can do that, why can't you just seize the football clubs and insist that all football clubs have a fan ownership scheme like they do in Germany, where 51% of the club is owned by the fans? Like, just do it. Just decide. Here's our opportunity to take football back from the hands of the billionaires and the countries, because actually we realise now with Abramovich it's completely wrong. The scales have fallen from our eyes. It took the invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin for the scales to fall from the eyes of football and football fans. And I think if football fans in England were to get together the way they did to kill the European Super League, they have a window of opportunity here to say, okay, actually, you know what? We could fix this. We could fix this right now if we all got together. And I think we're not that far away from this. We're really not that far away from this, where all the papers, every single one of the papers is like, got to get rid of Abramovich from Chelsea, but there's other questions that need to be asked of Newcastle and that need to be asked of Manchester City. And then do we stop there? Because Everton obviously have money from Usmanov. And I mean, ultimately, if a British billionaire buys Chelsea from Abramovich, what's the difference if it's just a plaything for rich people? This is a chance to take football back. I don't think they're going to take it, but if I was a football fan in England, I'd be like, is this our window of opportunity? Like, they had a game cancelled between Manchester United and Liverpool. They managed to cancel a game. The biggest game in world football was cancelled because the fans decided, we've had enough of this bullshit. Mm. But then they stopped. Then they stopped because the signings happened and everybody's like, oh, we got Ronaldo. Maybe that's more important.
Well, I mean, yeah. And like, what's going to be really interesting is that you talk about fans kind of coming together on this front. I think that there is a long way to go before that happens, because what we're seeing right now is a lot of sort of billionaire tribalism almost, where my billionaire is better than your billionaire. And it comes quite a lot if you look at the reaction to, say, Thomas Tuchel's press conference yesterday, being like, oh, my Tommy boy has done such a great job. Why aren't you asking the same questions of the UAE, or why aren't you asking the same questions of Saudi Arabia? And it's like, just because maybe it's not getting the same level of coverage doesn't mean that the same questions can't be asked. But it does seem that there is a constant sense of pointing at another club rather than accepting what may or may not be going wrong at your own club. I think that is the first step before you actually get to that point.
That's all politics.
Like, I think is it fair to be like disappointed with Tuchel yesterday? Like, he was pretty pissed off in a way that I'm not sure he had any right to be pissed off yesterday, to be quite honest. Like, he was saying that, I'm in a privileged position. I've never experienced war. That is fair. But you are also in a privileged position, a privileged enough position to work for Qatar and then subsequently work for Roman Abramovich. Your two bosses are Qatar and Roman Abramovich. I think if you're a pretty rich, pretty successful young manager, you have an opportunity. You have the privilege, as you said yourself, to say no to both of those things. If you really care that deeply to give out and to get pretty exercise in a press conference, then I would say that you probably care deeply enough to read up on Qatar and on Roman Abramovich to not take their money. So I'm not sure about that whole reaction from Thomas Tuchel. I definitely don't think that he's under any sort of, I don't think there's any injustice towards Chelsea Football Club this week whatsoever. Maybe some of the top brass at Chelsea could ship a few more blows, considering Tuchel is going to be the face of the club at every press conference. But other than that, I don't think there's any sense of injustice. But Chelsea fans think that. And that's the key point here. If you're talking about some sort of collective fan movement, the fans have never been more divisive as they are now.
Tuchel has got to think about that, though. He is the face of Chelsea. And when people talk Chelsea now, they talk Roman Abramovich. And this war has escalated so quickly and has united people so quickly against it. Like, Thomas Tuchel, I don't think, was asked yesterday about his own position. But if you're having to sit in a press conference 3-4 times a week and make excuses, or not defend, but somehow not comment on Roman Abramovich and his ownership and his links with Vladimir Putin, on a personal level, that's not a situation that Thomas Tuchel will want to be in. So do you get to a scenario quite quickly, if the club isn't sold, where Thomas Tuchel needs to consider his position as manager. Does he want to be the face of this day after day, week after week? Maybe it's something he's considered already, but watching him at the press conference yesterday, that was the thought I came away with, as to he probably would defend himself and say he's backed into a bit of a corner there, so what can he say? And maybe a press officer should come out alongside him and say, here is the club's stated position. But it is a personal thing now for an awful lot of people. And do you want to be in 5, 10, 20 years' time looking back at a press conference of you saying, well, there's nothing I could do about this? I'm not sure how sustainable that is for Thomas Tuchel. I also wonder, has a line been drawn in the sand in terms of ownership? Like, Roman Abramovich is trying to get a fire sale, as you say, to sort of get his assets out of Britain as quickly as possible. But the way football has always worked is, once this scenario is dealt with,
it disappears.
Just move on.
Exactly.
Like with Usmanov. So suddenly the focus is turning to him, and, well, actually, maybe his connections with Putin are even closer than that, Roman Abramovich. So he should be the focus. We need to get rid of him first, and then we'll think about Roman Abramovich. And how, I know you say about the Super League and fans uniting and all of that, but I don't know practically how you go about a scenario of handing it back. The only way that would work, I guess, is if you were to strip the club of Chelsea and suddenly the government owns this and can hand it over to a supporters' trust and
you have to say that what we've decided, we're taking this opportunity. Football is a community asset and no individual can own more than 49% of the club. It's a new rule. We're rushing it through Parliament. It's getting slapped in immediately and away we go. Like, there's a bunch of different mechanisms you could use to do it. The politicians could find a way if they decided that now was the moment they were going to do it. And, like, frankly, I'd be amazed if it wasn't the type of thing that would garner massive political support right now. Now, you'll obviously end up facing legal battles from the Glazers and the billionaire owners of Villa and Leeds and all of those other clubs. But tough. You want to own 49% of the club? That's great. If you don't, divest yourself of the asset. Because the leeching off of poor Owen here and the little money symbol over his head, we've got to stop that.
There's also then a very kind of like a smaller issue and all of that where the Premier League would just not want that themselves. Like, I mean, you talk about the money symbol over their head and they're like, wow, all these people from all over the world are willing to pay massive money for our television rights.
That's why they
don't
get
Ronaldo.
They don't get a vote. It's the people have decided that we don't want Abramovich, but we'll take this billionaire. This billionaire is okay. This billionaire is not okay. Do you know how he made his money? Do you really? Do you want to find out or do you not want to find out? And what about the situation in Yemen? And what about the situation in Abu Dhabi? And
what about then the other practical aspect of all of this? You're putting your trust in a British government that I would say is pretty nationalistic. And I would say that there are plenty of people in Westminster who get...
Every great plan has a fundamental flaw and you found ours really quickly.
I would say that they get like a great kick out of the fact, you know, when they see, you know, they ring their French buddies and they're like, our league is better than yours, or their Spanish buddies, and they say the same thing because we've got the biggest, beefiest, most well-resourced league in the world, and that's why our country is great, is what the English people who have power might say.
It's probably true, to be honest. It's not going to happen. I understand it's not going to happen, but now is the window of opportunity to start. Like, also, people telling you you can't do this because it turns out that's a lie. You can do whatever you want if it's for the greater good of most people. And it turns out, in moments of crisis, you can do absolutely anything you want. So, this is a moment of crisis, I would say. OTBAM is brought to you live each morning by Gillette Labs for an effortless finish to your day. We've got loads more to come. Very briefly, Nathan, before we let you go, Mayo up to second. You're trying to keep this on the down low.
It's been at second for a while, actually.
Sustaining in second, mm-hmm. Maintaining, improving.
The Mayo players, I'm sure, are just honoured to be on the pitch as the great David Clifford, and to be near a team ranked one. Is, you know, to be second to that great Kerry team and all they've won, it's a real honour. Yeah, I think there's a quiet confidence, if it could ever be such a thing, in Mayo at the moment. When you look at the bench that they've had, the character that's still there, like, they do this all the time.
It's now or never, though, right?
When they were relegated.
It is now or never. It is.
But it was now or never in 2016. It was now or never in 2017.
And it felt like never. It did feel like never. And it did feel like at the end of those...
They come back. Like, Mayo are at that very elite level where the players that are turning out, much like Kerry, in that if you want to get into that Mayo squad, you have to be of a certain level. And that hasn't really dipped, so...
But the age profile of this team, like, so Killian's coming back this year. And will he be able to maintain the level he's at for many more years? I don't know. Will Aidan O'Shea be happy with a bit part role for many years? I don't know. Also, the Dubs are at their weakest that they've been. Kerry aren't quite at the level they're going to get to with the two Wunderkinds who are coming into being a man at this stage. And they're going to be men for the best part of the next decade.
I think that they're close to their peak, to be honest. But
you're making excuses for Kerry already.
Yeah.
No, I'm saying
I'm putting a level of pressure on Mayo that having
got back to back on Ireland. This is the year. Kerry are going to get better and better. Dublin are going to come back.
Just on that Killeen O'Connor point, is there a world in which that he's just a bit power player like Aidan O'Shea this year? That James Horne's like, I like my starting team. What we could do with is a little bit more firepower. And I'm not, bit power player is completely underselling it. I'm talking about coming off the bench with 50 minutes on the clock.
Closer.
Playing half an hour.
A bomb squad.
Well, he may have no choice. Like, if Killeen O'Connor isn't back as of yet, and you know, the championship is going to be over in 4 months' time, and he hasn't played in a year, you know, how long is it going to take him to get back up to full inter-county fitness? So are you easing him back in over the provincial championship where Mayo are playing Galway? Like, can they afford to ease him back in? Like, he's not going to be first name on that team sheet in the next couple of months because they are going to have to manage his moments. So the hope, I'm sure, is that come end of June, July, that is when Killeen O'Connor is back to Killeen O'Connor at his absolute best. But like, he has suddenly an awful lot of depth. There's probably still, it's clearly not a transition. The transition is over, but there's still a lot of names there that people are getting used to and what their talents are and exactly what they do. Because like Lee Keegan, I think, was the only one who started against Armagh who had played in the 2017 All-Ireland final. So like, this is a young Mayo squad. You're talking about the Kerry squad getting better. A lot of these Mayo players are going to get better and better over the next couple of years. And maybe this generation can be just as strong as the generation that went before.
And can I just ask one question? Like, if Mayo were All-Ireland champions, how much would that change? Like, just by this, I know it's a big deal, but by dint of the fact that there would be a trophy sitting in the cabinet, I reckon Mayo will be favourites for this year's All-Ireland. And they're as big as, 6-1? They almost look like they're building. If they were All-Ireland champions, we'd be talking about these new fellas coming in being like, oh, as Dublin and Kilkenny showed in the past, you just need one or two new players to come into the squad every year to maintain that level. And that's what Mayo have shown at the start of this year. So I just think that there is still this kind of intangible thing about not having one in All-Ireland, which people are using to knock back Mayo's chances this year. Whereas if you look at the tangibles, they're in an extremely good position.
And that's understandable because they haven't won the All-Ireland. But I think if you're looking at a season as a whole, you have to look at the strength Mayo have and think they're going to be there in and around the semi-finals again. And from there, well, things always seem to happen, for good or for bad for Mayo. Whether they have that little bit of X factor that can get them over the line, whether they can score the penalty when they need to score the penalty, like, these things we won't know. But it was no freak that Mayo got to an All-Ireland over the last couple of years, it turns out. I think at times it felt in 2020 that there was I wasn't expecting this sort of bonus territory. Last year they back it up. Maybe they should have gone back it up again. But it's not. It's also not straightforward. Like, Connacht is suddenly stacked. Like, you know, having to play Galway or Roscommon to get through Connacht, otherwise you're going down a long route of qualifiers.
Well, they like the qualifiers, though. It'll suit this young team to be a bit off-Broadway if they don't make it through the front door, and they'll be underdogs.
Mayo are never off-Broadway. Broadway follows Mayo, Jer. It's a movable feast. remember when they went to Newbridge?
Sure, yeah, you managed to make a shit show of that, didn't you?
It was the the first time Broadway had come to Newbridge in a long, long time, Jerry.
Oh, look at you. What happened that day, Nathan? Did you win that game?
Well, hopefully Kildare follow up this great victory over the Dublin team as they followed up that great victory over the Mayo team.
You got a special prize for that too. Nathan, good stuff. Thanks a million. Always
Cheers,
a pleasure
lads.
To spend some time in your company of a Wednesday morning.
Thank you.
Right, let's move on. Phil Egan, good morning to you.
How are you doing,
lads? I can't believe your Gaelic football team is so shit.
Yeah, I mean,
how am I doing? Is that the right?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that how it works?
Keep it going.
I was kind of sitting here thinking, I mean, would you be celebrating a win over the Dubs? Because everyone's beating the Dubs these days.
It's true.
Six in a row.
It's like celebrating beating Liverpool last season.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look at some of the teams. Like, even Everton.
Shouldn't you do it every time you get the opportunity to? Because it might not come around again. Isn't that the other side of this?
Possibly. Like, well, yeah. The example there is Everton won at Anfield last season. And who knows when they'll win there again.
They thought that was a new normal.
Yeah, but there was no one there to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if we'd... Like, isn't it better that those couple of years that that we had to watch the boring football that Jack O'Connor provided for us at Kildare instead of the good stuff that we have now, that the crowds are all able to get there and see it.
Yeah, exactly. So I said about Liverpool last season, if you were going to have a season that was a bad one, which they still somehow rescued with a third place finish, but it, that was the time to do it when there was no fans there. They got their act together actually as the fans started to come back. Mm. Remember the last day of the season when they beat Palace to secure a top four finish, that they actually had 10,000 at Anfield. So don't waste your bad football on the fans. Waste it on the empty stadiums.
Yeah, a good idea. Before we get into Burnley, Leicester and the Premier League, we should talk about Crystal Palace last night in the Cup. Their young left back was an Irish kid, Teo Adaramola, who I think hasn't played that much yet for the first team, but it's a big enough game at this stage of the competition to be getting in. He's
it was his first start.
Played 60 minutes.
Yeah.
And you were not festooned with left backs. I mean, maybe we're playing a right back out of position at left back, but maybe now we have a left back who probably isn't going to play that much in the Premier League for the rest of the season, but certainly is being trusted in big moments.
Yeah, it always excites Irish football fans when they see a young Irish player being thrown into the first team. And people say it's the FA Cup, but Crystal Palace are one of those sides where give it a shot, because they're safe in the Premier League. I know Southampton and West Ham are playing tonight. There are two other clubs that you would think you have a fair crack. Maybe West Ham, like, I know they're probably have their eyes on the top four race as well, and they're still in the Europa League, but certainly a team like Southampton, who are in good form, would be targeting FA Cup success, and I would put Crystal Palace in the same bracket. So for Vieira to throw him in there, that can only be a good thing. And you know, the fact that he got over an hour, and Crystal Palace is Selhurst Park is one of those stadiums that on its night can be absolutely hopping, like, so great experience for him. And hopefully the sign of things to come.
The Ireland squad, it's going to be interesting to see who he names. Like, I don't know if any of the players who are in that age group at the moment are close to the Ireland squad for what's going to be a very important campaign from Stephen Kenny's perspective. Or do you bring them in and show them around and say, this is going to be you this time next year or the year after if you get your head down and get a few games? I don't know. What's the way to manage that throughput of players?
Well, I think like somebody like Adaramola, who's, you know, he's still a teenager, like his next step is a call up to the 21s. But yeah, there's players in the 21 squad that Stephen Kenny will have definitely earmarked for call ups to the senior squad, whether they're ready. Sometimes you see managers call up players just to train. I know Jack Byrne was on the show yesterday speaking to Nathan, and you know, he's still only 25. But you think back to when Martin O'Neill was in charge, I remember Jack Byrne was called in to train with the senior squad. I think it was him and Callum O'Dowda, because I remember Jack Byrne came into the press conference, this young lad who was on loan over in Holland but was on the books at Manchester City and was taking it all in a stride. But just to get a look at them and what they're like against the senior players.
Well, we played a clip of Cian Prendergast earlier on, who'd been called up to train with the Ireland rugby squad, and he said his brain was fried for the first few days, just kind of, oh, these are some of the best players in the world. Like, getting that out of the system as early as possible, so that when an injury it forces us to pick one of these players and play a game, because that frequently happens, where it's like you come from nowhere, you play a game, and maybe you stick in the squad or maybe you don't afterwards. Removing as much of the brain fry as possible would be good.
Yeah, absolutely. Also as well, like, if you're Stephen Kenny, you want to see how they adapt to the environment. And I'd say it's almost a case of, you look at their behaviour as well, not only what they do on the pitch but off the pitch. You know, do they interact with their teammates? What are they like? Can they handle it? Is it too much for them, or do they take it all in their stride? Just, you get to know about personalities, and knowing then if it comes to a big game that you can say, yeah, I'm throwing you straight in, I think you're ready for it, I think you can handle it, you've got the temperament for it.
Yeah, the other thing that came out in that Nathan interview with Jack Byrne was the text from Stephen Kenny. Yeah. You know, and not the fact that he did it, but the fact that it had such an impact. Like Jack Byrne said, I can't explain the impact that it had on me, but it really did have an impact. And that is the managerial, man management skills that we've heard people talk about that are intangible with Kenny. The players who've played with him, who got on with him over a long period of time, it seems would go to war for him pretty quickly. And I should really stop using language like that about sport, because it doesn't matter anymore. But anyway, like, that man management skill that he has is something that has clearly come across. And you know, I'm sure he's in contact with all these players who are making their debuts. And the other thing that was announced was a record season ticket sales.
Yeah.
For the Republic of Ireland. I don't know how long we've been keeping track of this, but it's very interesting. It's like the home slate of games this year is not great, is it?
No, well, obviously you've got the Belgium game later on this month, but there is something, and I think we've seen it with the start of the new League of Ireland season as well, there is some sort of a, like, there's a buzz about Irish football where it's maybe the fact that there's new people in the FAI, so it gives hope. But also, like, look, there's always been a massive interest in football in this country, and I think now it feels like there could be a change. Whether the League of Ireland gets the investment that it needs and deserves, then that can kick on. And obviously there's an excitement about the international team, because there's a lot of young players that have now been capped, and that only bodes well for the future. And the Nations League is obviously something that Stephen Kenny has targeted and then wants to bring it on into the European campaign. So, there is a real excitement about it. And you could see, even when the crowds came back for the last few games, just this team is, or the fans are behind this team and behind Stephen Kenny.
Yeah, and look, the players coming through at that age group, those kind of 17 to 21-year-olds, they're very promising. It's just, it feels like it might be a bit too early for them. Or maybe it's not. Maybe this is the campaign where they all smash their way to prominence at international level, and, you know, there's a good time coming. But it's hard, because we don't want to put too much pressure on them, and yet we also really desperately need them to deliver quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And it goes back to what I said earlier, even about, like, the whole strange situation of the start of Stephen Kenny's tenure, where there was nobody there and players were getting ruled out of games left, right and centre because of COVID, and just pretty much anything that could go wrong was going wrong. And towards the end of the World Cup qualifiers, looked like we turned that corner where we were starting to score goals, we were playing some nice football, the crowds were back, there was a buzz. And yeah, that was kind of what Stephen Kenny was aiming for, was just to blood all these players. And then obviously he would have liked to have got some more positive results in the campaign, but he always said it was about being stronger for the European Championship qualifiers. So that's where we're at, but it looks like we're on an upward curve, and it's probably no surprise then that all these people want season tickets.
Will we go back to the Premier League?
Yeah, you were watching Burnley last night?
Yeah, actually, speaking of Irish players, Nathan Collins actually came on in the game because Ben Mee went off injured fairly. Looked innocuous at the time. He just came in for a sliding tackle to dispossess Patson Daka, but soldiered on for about 10 minutes, even went up for a corner, and then he couldn't get back, and it's like, right, you're on, Nathan Collins. And Collins did okay. Burnley were doing what Burnley do. They were blocking shots, and, you know, I thought they would have success with set pieces given how bad Leicester have been. They've conceded from 18 set pieces this season, but they probably just didn't get enough corners, Burnley. And then Brendan Rodgers has the luxury in the 72nd minute of being able to say to James Maddison and Jamie Vardy, on you go. Interesting enough, Tielemans came off, and another game where he wasn't great, and obviously a lot of talk about where he's going to be next season, and maybe that's what we're seeing with him, that the head is thinking elsewhere.
I've heard you make the case that he might be a Virgil van Dijk, where it's grand, he's so good that he'll be able to bounce back straight away.
Yeah, because that was something, like, you know, people say if this is the way he is because he wants to get a move away, you know, people would question the character of a player. But that was said about Van Dijk, where he tried to get he got his move away from Celtic, then he wanted to get his move away from Southampton. And some people said, well, you know, what's going to happen when he's unhappy at Liverpool? Or he might think he wants to move away. And, I mean, none of that has happened. He's obviously been sensational, and nobody ever talks about Van Dijk leaving Liverpool.
Is Tielemans that good?
He's not going to be a game changer for a club the way Van Dijk has been for Liverpool, but he certainly is a very good player. He's technically very good, has a goal in him, and will complement plenty of the top teams in the Premier League. Who knows, maybe he has his eye on a move outside the Premier League. I'm sure there'll be plenty of teams in Europe that would be quite happy to have him in their midfield. In terms of what it did for the relegation scrap, you were kind of thinking with 20 minutes to go, Everton are going to be in the they were in the bottom three in the as things stand table until Maddison scored and then Vardy scored. But there's some big games this weekend. Obviously, Tottenham are coming off the disappointment of last night. They play Everton next Monday. So Everton will know going into that game where they are. Obviously, Leeds, first game for Jesse Marsh, is away to Leicester. And maybe it's a bad time from there because it looks like Vardy's going to be... You'd imagine Brendan Rodgers will put him straight back in. Maddison has been excellent. I'm not sure why he didn't start him. Maybe he was carrying a knock, but he scored two great goals in the Conference League last week for Leicester. So Leicester needed that win. That was their first win of 2022 in the league. So, you know, top half finish, maybe win the Europa Conference League. There's still a few teams in there, though, that will give them problems because they haven't been great in Europe. In terms of Burnley, they look like the only team in the bottom three that can get out.
Last night's a bit of a disaster for that, though, isn't it? They're the games that, like, so they put in really good performances against Chelsea, unlucky against Liverpool, good against Man United, like games where they're not supposed to pick up points, but against Leicester, who are not in free fall but are having a down season, you think, okay, this is it, like, go and win this.
Yeah, I did feel that Burnley would have enough to get a point out of it where they could just... That was Leicester's first clean sheet away from home in the league this season as well. So, Burnley, you mentioned Chelsea there. They obviously drew at Stamford Bridge. They actually play Chelsea at Turf Moor on Saturday afternoon. So, another game to watch as well this weekend in terms of the fight for survival is you've got Norwich and Brentford.
Brentford, Leeds is who Burnley are eyeing up, not Everton.
Yeah. Now, saying that though, Christian Eriksen came off the bench last week in the defeat to Newcastle and showed glimpses. There was a lovely ball where he played first time, and you wonder, could he be the player that just gives Brentford that bit of a spark that gets them going again? Because it looked like they'd be okay. I didn't pick them to go down at the start of the season. I just thought they're a bit of an unknown quantity, a bit like Sheffield United were when they came up, and they have a certain way of playing, they'd be quite tough to beat in their own patch. And that's the way it started, but teams maybe have worked them out a bit. Also, just as the season goes on, you start picking up injuries and it just becomes a bit of a slog. And the more games you lose, obviously the confidence is taking a bit of a hit. So maybe Eriksen could be the player to turn it around for them. Hard to know what is going to happen with Leeds. You know, they've 12 games to save it. In terms of getting rid of Bielsa, they've got rid of him at the end of the tough run of games where I kind of wondered if he could see out the Spurs game, then you were going into games where you think, right, they can actually start winning a few of these. But obviously Leeds decided enough is enough, and now it's a time for Jesse Marsh. How do you get out of a Marcelo Bielsa thinking team with 12 games to go? The only positive for Leeds fans is Jesse Marsh would, like, the players that they have will suit the way that he wants to play. But he'll have to tweak things. This whole man-for-man thing, that's gone.
Leeds play Brentford on the final day of the season.
Yeah.
My money's on that being possibly a relegation off.
Could be. I know Burnley play Newcastle as well.
Newcastle will definitely be
safe. I think
Newcastle
will be all right.
And I would definitely have Burnley ahead of Brentford and Leeds on current form.
Yeah.
Maybe on paper if Leeds get their full team back, but they won't have their full team back by the end of the season, it changes things.
Yeah. I mean, there's very little talk about Bamford or Phillips. So you wonder, are they going to play again this season?
That's it.
Bamford, I don't know. I mean, maybe Jesse Marsh will be a bit more up front, but then again, Bielsa's usually he's quite honest when he's asked questions, he'd no problem telling you. But you wouldn't worry about Everton, no?
Not with the quality that they have, I think anyway, and I think that they have got a win in the last couple of weeks. I think just a win for what that does for a relegation threatened team is just like a rocket fuel. And of course, they've had a disappointing result since then, and they looked better against Manchester City, which is definitely something they'll cling to. But Brentford and Leeds just can't get a win at the moment.
No.
Like, they just can't get 3 points on the board, and that's if you just get one of them, then away you go. But it's just hard to see how the two of them win games at the moment, so I'd be very worried. I think Everton and Newcastle are just cut above that crew at the moment, and then it's a three horse race, I think, for that one.
Yeah,
spot.
Absolutely.
I think Burnley are better than the other two.
Yeah, I think Norwich are done, even though Norwich are obviously playing Liverpool tonight in the FA Cup, and Dean Smith has pretty much said, like, his all eyes are on this weekend, which goes back to what I was saying about certain clubs. just can't have a proper crack at the FA Cup. They don't feel they can because, look, we saw it even last night with Spurs. Spurs put out their strong 11, but they couldn't back up the performance from the other day. So that seems to be an issue under Conte, where they can't put in decent back-to-back performances. So does that go is that to do with the intensity he wants them to play with?
What do you think? What's your theory? Like, there is a possibility that it's to do with conditioning for what he wants to do and what his style of play is. But it really is I never understand how at this point, when the science is so good, that conditioning is better for one team than another.
Yeah, I don't, like, you can be as well conditioned as you want, but if you're playing two games at high intensity in a week, obviously the second game is going to take its toll a bit more. And when he won the league with Chelsea, one thing he had in his favour was he had no European football that season, because they'd been so bad the season before with Mourinho, and obviously Hiddink had come in as well. Like, so it appears that would be one of the concerns. Also, as well, you factor in that, you know, Spurs, we've known for years that nothing surprises you with Spurs anymore. The fact that they could follow up a great win over Man City with a defeat at Burnley. But the encouraging thing is they're creating chances in those games.
Yeah.
So they've 6 days to recover for that game against Everton on Monday night.
Yeah, and it's not a bad fixture to get right.
No, and I just wondered with Everton. I wouldn't worry about them going down, but I just wondered what it would be like psychologically to drop into the bottom three at this stage of the season.
Let's see. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to see.
If Burnley need to get a draw or better against Chelsea on Saturday for that to happen, I can't see that happening.
All right, we've got to go. Feel good stuff. Great to have you back. Thanks a million.
OTB. AM. With Gillette. Get into your flow with the new Gillette Labs Razor with exfoliating bar.